Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland.
Tonight we take you on the hunt with some of the unsung crime fighters behind the long arm of the law. Despite a history that traces back to President George Washington, the U.S. Marshals Service is still a bit of a mystery to a lot of folks. They do cover a lot of ground, handling everything from federal court security and prisoner transport to secret witness protection. But they are also the nation's primary fugitive hunters, as more than 100,000 wanted men and women who wind up in their sights every year learn the hard way.
You can run.
Police, U.S. Marshals!
But you can rarely hide from these guys. The U.S. Marshals' fugitive task forces don't solve crimes. Their job? Hunting down the most dangerous of wanted suspects.
Does this guy have any weapons history?
The marshals comb databases. They question friends and associates in what is often a cat and mouse game to the very end.
They'll have false compartments built into their dressers. They'll have sections cut out of the flooring in their home. We found people hiding in the air vents.
Barely 3 hours in, they'd caught their second fugitive, wanted on a weapons warrant.
Slot in, have a seat right there.
The task force teams, located across the country, are made up of marshals and other federal agents, along with state and local cops. At times, the work is frustrating.
We're a step behind him. Like always, we're going to have to develop something to send us in the right direction from here.
That something comes an hour later.
The marshals have received a lead that a fugitive sex offender may be nearby. They've pulled off here in this parking lot to brief their tactics before they hit it.
Just before sunset, they move in. They make an arrest. The next morning, as they close in on a shooting suspect.
Y'all ready to move up?
He won't come out. So they breached the door, and finally,
he realized that we weren't going away, and he decided to go ahead and surrender to us.
He's the team's 399th fugitive arrest of the year. As far as the other names on their list, they're on notice.
We're not going to stop looking for you, so you might as well just go ahead and call it quits, because we're never going to give up. We do not quit.
From humble beginnings, Dave Gonzalez rose through the ranks of Copland to become the United States Marshal for Arizona, having served in that role for the last 18 years. A man whose life and career has been dedicated to the very highest levels of public service, safety, and protection. Dave lost his mother at a very early age and was raised by his grandparents. The lessons he learned as a boy carried Dave forward into life.
Yeah, you know, Jay, I was born and raised in Flagstaff. And when I was 10 years old, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And she died a year later. And I went to live with my grandparents on my mother's side. And had seven brothers and sisters, and we kind of got scattered out with the family in Flagstaff, aunts, uncles. And I was blessed to be raised by Ramon and Virginia Otero, my mother's parents. And they were just the hardest working people you ever want, not very educated. He was a small store owner in Flagstaff, on the south side of Flagstaff. And he would tell me these stories, little short stories, Mexican short stories. They're called dichos, and that's how he would prepare me for life. Like he would say, like for example, honest sweat has no odor. We know that's nonsense, but I knew what he meant. You know, hard work, do what you have to take to take care of yourself and to make yourself better.
Dave's first encounter with the police had a positive impact on his view of the profession.
We would go to Northern Arizona University lumberjack games on Saturday nights in Flagstaff, and we couldn't afford to get in. So what we would do is we would sneak, we would go into the, next to the stadium at the time, it was a cemetery, and we would sneak into the cemetery and And it's unusual. It was the same cemetery my mother was buried in, and we'd crawl underneath the fence and get into the Eastside Stadium that way. And you know, a couple of buddies, we're probably 12, 13 years old. We just wanted to watch the Lumberjacks play. And we crawled underneath the fence from the cemetery, and we were sneaking over to the stadium to watch a game, and a Flagstaff police officer grabs us and by the collar. And we thought we were going to prison, you know, and we're crying, and we thought, this is it, you know. And he took us to the stadium, took us to the middle of the stadium where the seats were, put us in the best seats, and says, don't move. And walked away. And we thought he was coming back to get the paddy wagon or something. But he never came back. And then, I don't know, maybe towards the end of the game, he looked at us and he smiled like he was taking care of us. And I remember thinking, oh, that was a pretty good deal. And I'll never forget that police officer who was helping these poor little kids out by getting them into the game. And he'd probably been there.
While attending Northern Arizona University, Dave went on a ride-along and he was hooked.
So I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. I wanted to be a history teacher, and I took a public safety police class, and it was a Flagstaff police officer in one of my classes, and we got to be good friends. And he says, "Hey, why don't you come? What are you doing Friday night? Let's go. Why don't you do a ride along with me?" And I always liked cops. I always respected them. And I thought, oh, okay, got nothing going. So I rode with this Flagstaff police officer. And it changed my life. It was like, my God, this is pretty exciting. We went to a shooting, went to burglary in progress. And I was hooked. I was hooked, you know. It was like, especially for a young man, you could drive fast, chase bad guys. And at that moment, I knew I wanted to be a police officer.
Dave got his start in law enforcement with the Coconino County Sheriff's Department. At 19 years old, he was already on patrol responding to calls when a veteran police chief recognized his potential.
The sheriff in Coconino County, where Flagstaff's the base, is a guy named Joe Richards. And he was also born and raised in the area. And I applied to be a detention officer in the jail. I was 19 years old, and Joe Richards hired me. And initially as a detention officer. I went to a regional academy, and I worked the jail for about 3 months, and then they put me in a patrol car shagging calls out in the county. And Coconino County is a huge county. It's the second largest by landmass. And thinking back at it, I had no business being in a patrol car. You know, it was interesting because at 19 years old, and even 20, I could not buy a gun or bullets. And yet I was a police officer. If I wanted bullets for my gun, I'd have to go ask my sergeant to run me down to the store to buy bullets for me. And it was Joe Richards, the sheriff of Coconino County, who saw something in me. And there's always somebody in your background that gives you that hand. Jay, you probably have somebody that brought you along, and Joe Richards was that guy this punk kid at 19 years old, he saw something in me. And gave me a shot, and seen something in me that I didn't see in myself, and I'll never forget that. And I think about that as I went through, on the ranks with the State Police Department of Public Safety here in Arizona as U.S. Marshal. Is there's somebody out there like me that needs a helping hand, because he made a big difference in my life.
Dave left the sheriff's department to become a state trooper patrolling the highways with the Arizona Department of Public Safety.
Well, the way that happened, I spent 2 years as a sheriff's deputy, and I was born and raised in Flagstaff, and I wanted to go to the big city. And I was hired, went through the academy, and they sent me to Tucson, which was absolutely perfect because I was able to continue my studies at the University of Arizona. I worked highway patrol as a trooper for 2 years. To me, that was one of the best jobs ever because you were on your own. And I loved the Smokey the Bear hat. We had, nice, clean, up-to-date equipment. And you were on your own. I check on at 9 o'clock at night, and I was responsible. Maybe there might be maybe another trooper out there if you were lucky. And you were responsible for the whole county. And you grow up very quickly. And I was 21 years old doing this, and you would be involved in high-speed chases, or you'd be involved in the most god-awful accidents that you can imagine. And then I would do that at night and then go to class in the mornings.
Dave's first sergeant gave him a simple piece of advice that he still holds dear today.
I had a sergeant. It was my first sergeant, and I wouldn't see him that often because I was working the graveyard shift, and he worked the nights, and in the mornings I would see him sometime, and he gave me one of the best pieces of advice I've ever had, and it was only four words, Jay, and it was, don't water plastic plants. Dave, he says, that's all you have to remember about life. And what he meant was, don't spend time, energy, money on things that aren't going to grow. You know, whether it's in your personal life, within school, with your relationships, whatever, don't water plastic plants. And I've never forgot that today. So, well, we slip up sometimes, but I think it was some of the best advice that I ever got. And occasionally I'll sit back and say, am I watering plastic plants, doing things that or watering things that I should not be, that aren't going to grow?
Dave was offered an opportunity to join the DPS narcotics unit and hunt drugs in southern Arizona.
There was a big push in southern Arizona for narcotics agents. Things were just going crazy at that time. This would be in the late 70s, and I was 23 and I looked like I was 16. And they were looking for troopers that spoke some Spanish, could go undercover, I was the captain in narcotics that recruited me and said, hey, would you like to work narcotics? You don't have to wear a uniform anymore. Not that I didn't mind wearing a uniform. It just you can infiltrate these organized crime groups, these cartels. Well, and it sounded very interesting. So after 2 years, I transferred to the narcotics division, which was a fascinating time in my life also.
Dave's transition from the rigid uniform standards of a state trooper to the slacking undercover persona of a narcotics trafficker was a smooth one.
I took pride in my uniform. I'd shine my brass. I'd polish my boots, spit polish. I liked tight creases. I prided myself in uniform. The next day, yeah, I'm growing my hair out. You look like somebody on the street that would look like they're involved in some nefarious activities. And DPS had a huge narcotics division at the time, and they were expanding it greatly then in the late 70s, especially with all the marijuana coming across, and also crack cocaine was also coming into effect at that time, which changed the country, actually, a lot, especially with gangs.
In one of Dave's first assignments, he flipped a drug dealer into an informant and was introduced to a large-scale marijuana trafficker.
There was a guy here in Tucson. His last name was Valenzuela. And he was a well-known marijuana smuggler. And everybody wanted to take him down. He was prolific. And I had an informant, Jay, and you know how important informants are in narcotics. You can be a great undercover person, it's those informants that really push the case along. And I had a good informant that I had bought some cocaine off him, and a couple of grams, not a big deal. But at the time, he was facing 5 years in prison. And I went to him one day and I said, listen, do you want to spend 5 years in prison? Or would you like to work with me? And it was just the realities of life, whether you like it or not. That's the way it is. And you sit down and you talk to them and you find out what crimes they were involved in, who they knew. And he mentioned, hey, I know a guy named Valenzuela. And you know, Mike perked up. He goes, I can do him for you. I'll duke you in. I'll introduce you to him. So he duked me into Valenzuela, and I negotiated to buy 800 pounds of marijuana from him. He introduced me to Valenzuela. We negotiated, and came time to make the transaction.
Dave was held at gunpoint during the negotiations, which landed him in his own neighborhood.
We met at a parking a shopping center up in north, just north of Tucson here. And we talked, and we determined that I would go with Valenzuela to pick up the dope. My partner would stay with his buddy. With the money. and would do the transaction. So I get into his car, and he had one of those big SUVs, a big Bronco or something. And I sit next to him, and as soon as I get in, he puts a 45 to my head, and he says, lay down on the floorboard. And I had a bug on, and there was an airplane up ahead, a surveillance airplane. Little did I know that the airplane had problems and was not on me, and the bug wasn't working. Those old-time bugs, you never knew. So I'm feeling pretty confident that I'm covered. So we drive and drive for, I don't know, about 10 minutes. And I could sense we're coming into a neighborhood starting to slow down. And I can hear a garage door going up. So we go into a garage. And he closes the garage door. And he goes, okay, you can get out. And as I get out, as the door is probably about three quarters down, I realize I'm about three blocks from my own house. You know, so I'm thinking, oh, my God, I live right down the street here. And he apologizes, Dave. I didn't mean to. No offense. He says, I don't want you to know where I live.
The suspect's use of his children in the drug deal reinforced Dave's commitment to make the case.
So as we go into the house, he calls his children. He had about three, four children, and they were from like 12 to 8 years old. And he said, "Hey, get the scales ready. Start bringing in the dope." His kids helped us weigh the marijuana. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can hardly wait to bust this guy. So we weigh and load up the dope into his truck. And he says, hey, this is great. He says, you want a beer before we go back? I said, yeah, sure. So follow him to the kitchen, and on his wall, I see these plaques. It said, Valenzuela, Rene Valenzuela, first degree black belt. The next one said second degree black belt. And the third one said third degree black belt. And I'm thinking, I'm in trouble. He's a third degree black belt with a 45. This is going to be interesting. So we're going back to consummate this drug deal. And I'm trying to figure a way to get the advantage on him when I get back. And I said, Ray, you know, that marijuana wasn't as good as you said it was. There's a lot of shake and seeds in it. I didn't know. I was just trying to come up with a cover story. Because at this time, he saw dollar signs and lots of money. And I said, half this money is my partner's, and I'm going to have to let him know that, hey, because if he doesn't like it, this deal's down, and we're both screwed. He said, no, don't talk to him. Make sure that straighten this thing out. So I said, I'll get out. When we get to the parking lot, the shopping center, I'll get out, and I'll tell Steve everything's okay. So I went up to Steve, and I said, Steve, this guy is bad news. He has a gun. Move in the guys now. Because we had backup for move-in signals, you know, things like that. I said, call the guys in right now. So he called them in through the visual signals that you would give through the surveillance. And he arrested him, and everything was fine.
The arrest of the suspect wasn't the end of the story. It got worse and even more dangerous.
He gets out of jail on bond about 3 weeks later, and I'm out jogging one day. I'm about 3 miles from my house, and I see this car coming. I said, he had a unique afro. I said, oh, that silhouette looks interesting. Well, it was Valenzuela, and he sees me, and I see him, and he hits the brakes, and he starts coming after me, and I'm running through the neighborhood, jumping fences, you know. And I finally hid behind someone's tool shed until he was driving around trying to find me. He never did. I called my sergeant. I said, told him what was going on. And back then, things were different. The sergeant got a hold of my squad. They went and had a chat with him and never had a problem with him again.
When marijuana was king along our southern border, the size and scope of those transactions caused special problems for the drug officers, in addition to the inherently treacherous nature of buying narcotics undercover.
I always hated doing marijuana deals because of the weight involved, the bulkness of it. It was always a nightmare. I would have preferred to do cocaine cases or heroin cases were a little different also because of the people you're involved with. But yeah, there's so much going on and the business that was involved in it. And there was, you know, you knew in a minute it could go to hell very, very, very quickly. because I was carrying firearms. I'm assuming they were, and you really had to be you had to think quickly, on your feet, as you know. And but the thing is, I always learned about don't water plastic plants. If I saw things going badly or I wasn't in control, I would blow it off. And I always thought, we can come back another day. You know, it's not worth getting hurt or killed for a room full of drugs.
Dave's willingness to walk away from a deal made him safer in his duties and more credible in the eyes of his suspects.
And I always went in as like, I don't care if this thing goes or not. And I never went in as a user. I went in as someone that wanted to make money. I think they trusted that more. Plus, one of the big issues with narcs is they want you to snort cocaine. They want you to smoke the blunt with you to show that you're not a cop. And, you know, you're put in that situation all the time. And sometimes people would say, hey, you didn't snort this line or you didn't smoke this marijuana. I don't want to deal with you. Fine. I'll move on. I'll find somebody that will. But if you went in with the idea that I'm a businessman, I think they respected that more because they felt it was protecting them also. They weren't going to get busted because you're dealing with some idiot.
After leaving the role of an undercover operative, Dave was handed his own narcotics unit to supervise.
I worked the streets for about 3.5 years, and then I got promoted to sergeant, and where I supervised an undercover squad. And that was unusual because ideally you want to get a new supervisor in to supervise undercover people because it's very difficult to supervise people that you worked undercover with for 3.5 years. Because Jay, as you know, you're doing some stuff out there. You're out all night. You're at topless bars. There's women. There's drugs. There's a lot of things that can go wrong out there. The perception sometimes that undercover narcs are out just running wild. But the time I got promoted to sergeant, there were no other troopers on the list for sergeant for Tucson that had narcotic experience. And so they left me as the supervisor, which then I supervised a squad of 7-8 undercover narcs in southern Arizona.
While in his assignment as a supervisor, Dave met his wife. Her career path forced Dave to expand his own.
I think one of the best things that also happened to me, I met my wife at the U of A. She was in law school there. And which about this time, she got out of law school and said, hey, this law firm in Phoenix wants to hire me. Can you transfer to Phoenix? I said, absolutely. And so the only job available in Phoenix at the time was working at headquarters doing management reviews of the different units of the department. And it's a pretty big department. And it was the best thing that happened to me because I sometimes think back, what if I would have stayed in NARCS, for the rest of my career? And I was happy. It was fun. You're running and gunning. The adrenaline rush of doing search warrants, doing buy busts. I love doing these long surveillances, even the wiretaps, the Title IIIs that went on for 2-3 months and were a lot of fun. And I probably never would have left that, but if it wasn't for my wife and who kind of in the situation brought me to Phoenix working out of our headquarters, that put me in a position where I was able to learn about administration, management, budget, that set me up for a promotion to climb the ladder at the state police.
Dave rose to the position of commander at DPS.
I oversaw the gang units, organized crime, SWAT teams, all the things in the Criminal Investigation Bureau, which was about 400 detectives at the time.
As Dave developed his management style, he learned to focus on the future and the value of honest evaluation.
Obviously, when I started out, I thought I was going to be a trooper riding down the highways the rest of my career. I would see some sergeants, and I would say, you know, if that guy can be a sergeant, I can be a sergeant. And I'm a sergeant, and I see a lieutenants, and I'd say, you know, if that person could be a lieutenant, I can be a lieutenant. You know, because I would see, wait a minute, I think I have a little bit more ball on the ball, or I think I think I can do a little bit better. But the way I looked at as I went through the ranks is, first of all, is to me, I always admired the leaders or my supervisors that had a vision. You know, there's people that come to work every day. They do the same stuff. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And they can't see past next week. To me, I always was attracted to and always followed people that say, okay, in a year from now, this is we're going to be. And also, and this is just not in law enforcement. I think it's everywhere, is people do not like telling other people their faults. I respected supervisors that when I was coming on, they'd say, David, you messed up on this. You would do better if you did this, this, and this. Or on this report, you did a lousy job. Rewrite this and put this in there. And yeah, I'd be pissed for a little bit, but I respected them. And I always looked for supervisors, and I wanted to be a supervisor where I could sit down with somebody that worked for me and say, these are the issues we need to work on, both, and you know, and the good things. And they could walk away and they could learn from that.
Behind a law enforcement career that began in 1975 and continues today, Dave has watched the profession evolve.
What's changed is society has changed tremendously, and which is, you know, an interesting part about law enforcement. I think that the police agencies have not adapted to the change. And, you know, I mentioned about vision and seeing down the road. We did not prepare for the changes that were coming, and the signs were there. We're supposed to be detectives. We're supposed to pick up things. For example, I never thought that marijuana would be legalized in the majority of the country. When I'm out buying hundreds of pounds of dope thinking, I'm doing the Lord's work, and now people don't care, you know? And so you think, God, you know, what else is coming down the road? And it should be a wake-up call to all of us. In Arizona, I think marijuana is going to be legalized in the next year or two, and it's one of those things, and we have not prepared for that. But the major part that I think has changed is when I came on is like we were there, you know, to do the Robert Peel things. You make, you know, you protect the citizens, and the absence of crime is you know that you've done a good job. Now, over the years, with all these, it could be government programs, the way things have shifted, police departments have been dumped on with all society's problems. Education, you know, poverty, mental health issues. And if you monitor any police department's radio frequencies, you'll see that the majority of calls for service have to do with societal issues, and they're not really crime issues. You know, and we were never designed, law enforcement, police department designed to do that. And now that's where we're headed. Where we make house calls, and that's where we're going. And it's going to get better. It's going to get worse. Where we're going to have to deal with all these issues, and where maybe where the government has not taken care of a lot of mental health issues, PTSD, all these things that now cops on the street have to deal with. And to me, those are the biggest changes.
Dave has been the United States Marshal for Arizona for the past 18 years. The Marshal Service has a long and distinguished history that he is very proud of. Our conversation was interrupted when Dave had to address his agents on the street attempting to apprehend a dangerous fugitive.
Wyatt Earp and, you know, Bass Reeves and the Indian country in Oklahoma and the vast history, and it goes back to George Washington. My position is appointed by the president. I was initially appointed by President George W. Bush. And then I was fortunate enough to be reappointed by President Obama and then also President Trump. And it goes back to 1789 with the first judicial act of Congress, where George Washington appointed the first 13 U.S. Marshals. And that tradition has maintained. And we're a very small agency in DOJ. There's only like 4,000 deputy marshals in the country. And our duties have evolved throughout the years, where we do, you know, we hunt down fugitives worldwide. We help our state and local tribal partners hunt down their dangerous fugitives. As we're speaking right now, we have a barricaded subject almost in central Tucson, who's a very dangerous man. And I hope, hope that works out. No one gets hurt. And also, the other another thing that we do is it's very interesting, and it's probably one of the best kept secrets in the U.S. is the Witness Protection Program, which is a very fascinating program, or then the individuals that come in into the Witness Protection Program and managing that. We also are responsible for the protection of the federal judges and the courthouses. These thousands of federal judges throughout the country, they're threatened on a daily basis. The decisions they make are affects a lot of lives. So we investigate those threats to the judiciary and the federal courthouses. And one of the biggest jobs that I have that keeps me up at night also is I'm responsible for all the pretrial federal prisoners that are waiting for court. And in Arizona, that's a lot because of we're a border state. This morning I have about 5,000 prisoners in custody that we're managing to get through the system, and our job is to get them to court for their court appearances, to make sure that it's safe, and then once their sentence, the arrangements are made to get them to the prison if that's where if they're sent when their case comes to a close. And we also do the asset forfeiture segment of for DOJ on the asset forfeiture issues on the ill-gotten gain of organized crime people that we take care of. Those are the primary functions of the United States Marshal Service.
A fugitive capture that Dave is uniquely proud of related to a case we were both familiar with.
Yeah, I have several of them, and one of them is you're very familiar with, Paul Eichheit. You know, I'm speaking to the choir with you here, Jay, but Paul was a stockbroker during the daytime. He looked great. He looked very professional. But at night, he was a Hell's Angel. And he was involved in the murder of Cynthia Garcia, brutally murdered at the clubhouse. You could probably tell the story better than I do. And it took years before that came out. I think it was a case you were involved in. I've had a lot of them at this one because of what he did to that poor woman. Cynthia Garcia was a woman down on her luck, and she was a couple of Hell's Angels, and Paul Eichheit was one of them. Asked her she wanted to go to a Hell's Angels party. She did go, and something terribly went wrong there. The information is that she said some things she probably shouldn't have said to these guys, and stabbed her dozens of times. Nearly decapitated her and left her body out in the desert east of Phoenix. And her murder went unsolved for a couple of years, and he was arrested for her murder along with another Hell's Angel. For some reason, a federal judge released him on OR, but put an ankle monitor on him. Well, you know what happened next. Paul cut off his ankle monitor, picked up a passport on an individual that looked just like him. I could see where somebody would understand it, or could see that or be involved in that ruse, and he disappeared. And we picked up that case, Jay, and we tracked him all over U.S., Canada. I sent deputy marshals to England, I think twice. Doing all the things, all the investigative things we do to track fugitives. And this one we really, really wanted because of who he was and what he did, and for the children of Cynthia. And lo and behold, we get information that he was getting money down in Buenos Aires. And we knew a place that he had to be visiting to pick up money from family members, because we know this happens when you're chasing fugitives. And during a surveillance in this neighborhood, he comes walking up one day to a Casa de Cambio to pick up some money where he was arrested. And it was a good day for us. The frustrating part, but we were so used to it now, it took 7 years to get him back to the U.S. because he fought extradition and fought extradition. And that happens a lot with some countries. But we eventually got him back. He had the resources. He had, support from the Hell's Angels internationally, and when you have somebody like that that can reach out and to get funding, resources, Because, you know, if you're on the lam, there's two things you need. Is you need to talk to people, and you need money. And, you know, and that's what helped. You know, that's what we use also. But it made it very difficult. It took years because he was bouncing around all over the world. But we were able to finally track him down to Buenos Aires. And he did not want to come back to the U.S. And he fought it. But finally, his appeals finally ran out in Argentina.
Dave speaks to the inherent dangers of pursuing desperate and violent fugitives, reflecting on the recent murder of one of his own deputy marshals in Tucson.
The U.S. Marshals Service were involved in more critical incidents involving shootings than all the other federal agencies combined. We've lost over 400 deputy marshals and marshals over our history. We're involved in more shootings, more use of less and lethal. And, you know, it was funny, Jay. I've been the U.S. Marshal in Arizona for 18 years. I lost a deputy marshal, Chase White, who was killed last November. But I remember it was a week before, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm the marshal for 18 years. I'm the leader here, and I've been very fortunate. I hadn't had anybody killed in line of duty. And a week later, Chase White was killed here in Tucson. Very, very tragic incident. And how do you deal with those kind of things? Because there's so much that goes on with that, with the families, with the deputy marshals and the local officers that were there. How do you deal with them? And you know, Jay, I tell you, even today, I wake up at night thinking, did I do everything that I possibly could do to help or could have saved Chase White? Could I have provided better equipment? Could I have done better training? You know, was there something that could have, should have, could have been done to that would have prevented that? And you just rack your brain and rack your brain, and I think that's what all leaders need to do, and I think it also comes down to selecting the right personnel, the right supervisors. Do I have the right supervisors? And you go through all those different issues, and you never get over those. Yeah, we're good at doing the pomp and circumstances and the playing of the taps and the bagpipes, and that is beautiful and all good. But when that day's over, now what?
Dave discusses the burden he carries as a leader, concerned for the people that work under him.
What I have to do, what I think all leaders have to do, is on a daily basis, do you look at those issues? Are we being supervised? Are troops being supervised properly? Do they have the right training? Do they have the right equipment? Do the officers that are out there have the right mentality? Are they burned out? Are they tired? Are there any issues that might affect that, or have any personal issues, drinking issues? Who knows? Those things can affect all those things. Some things you know about, some things you don't. And also, when I was with DPS, I had three or four officers, troopers in my academy that were killed in line of duty. When I first week in narcotics here in Tucson as a DPS officer, one of my squad mates was killed at the Tucson airport in a drug deal. And you know it's going to come, and you know it's going to happen. This is a tough, tough world and a tough, tough business. It's just that, are we doing everything possible that we can do to make sure that we prevent as many as we can? And you know, Jay, I God forbid, I know it's going to happen again down the road. And the last deputy marshal killed in Arizona was in 1952. And of all the, you know, 6,000 arrests that we make every year, it's phenomenal, the safety. But it was, you know, since 1952 that the last one. And I hope it's not I hope it's another 52 or never that it occurs. But I know it's going to happen again. And we just got to make sure that we do everything possible to prevent it.
Dave speaks on how the core principles of Christianity have impacted his life.
I grew up in a strict Catholic household. I went to Catholic schools. I was an altar boy. And, you know, and then it seems like when you get to college, you get in your teen years, you kind of drift away from religion and faith a little bit. And I got to tell you, I was really bitter, if you will, about faith and God when my mother died. You know, like, what kind of God would allow, a mother with 11 kids from, you know, 11 to 1 year old die, you know, and you kind of I guess maybe a lot of people get into that kind of a rut, but you know, it was when my wife and I had children, and we kind of were like religious, faithful, but didn't really participate much. And I think it was back when my kids, my daughter and son, were both born. And I thought it was important for me when I was young, and I think I think I was saying to myself, it'd be important for them, for my kids. Well, I really was thinking and really meant it was really important for me, you know? And it's interesting because when you get in trouble, you're always, you know, you say, people get real religious when they're in trouble. I remember being on maybe a high-speed pursuit, or you're in an ugly situation out in the middle of nowhere, and you'd say, God, get me out of this, and, you know, I'll go on the straight and narrow, you know. And as I find, as I get a little older, that faith becomes a little bit more important to me. You do the right things. You help people when you need to. For me, it's has graduated into being a good person to your family and to the people you meet on a daily basis, and even the strangers that you meet, and to the waitress that serves you coffee in the morning. So that's kind of like the way I look at it at this point.
Dave credits his family and their understanding for much of his success.
I tell you, I know that I wouldn't have been as successful as I have been going through the ranks with the state police, being appointed the United States Marshal, initially if it wasn't for my wife, who supported me in these endeavors, and also as a sounding board, you know, because sometimes you think that you know everything, I've done some important things in my life, and I would bounce it off my wife, Nancy. And, you know, we kind of joke, I know when I'm in trouble with my wife or I'm off on the wrong path, because she'll say, David, think back when you had an open mind, you know. So we'll laugh about it, and I'm thinking, maybe my mind hasn't been so open. And it's the same with my children.
Dave encourages others to set goals and to have patience in reaching them.
People really know what's right and what's wrong, and to follow that inner glow that's burning in people. And everybody has it. Some listen to it and some don't. And just go for the brass ring at all times. And sometimes you might not get what you want initially, but sometimes take tiny steps. You know, if you want to work for a small police department in your community, start there. And then if you decide down the road that you might want to move forward, but just get into the game.
Dave closes discussing the special circumstances that face today's lawmen and women while encouraging others to enter the profession.
This is difficult times for law enforcement, you know, with all the issues with Ferguson and, you know, body cameras, you know, the issues within some of our communities, the mistrust. And I believe we had some of that coming, but majority of it, we didn't. And if there's people out there that feel that maybe they don't want to get in law enforcement because of some of the negative things they see in social media or on television, you know, I would tell them, it's really not like that on the street. I think the majority of Americans support law enforcement. It is a difficult time, and the pendulum always swings back and forth. It's just like politics, and it's with a difficult time that American law enforcement is going in through now. I think the pendulum will swing back, but I think it's one of the best. Well, I think it is the best career that a young man and woman can be involved in. You really get a lot out of it, but it's like anything else. You have to give also.
Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless and go be amazing.